This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at the University of Chicago and NYU, to discuss retroactivity. Retroactivity is in the news because in a proposal from the Biden administration, in order to raise revenue to pay for the investment of the trillions that the Biden administration is proposing, there is one little detail about capital gains taxes that already is controversial because the president administration is proposing to raise capital gains from about 23% to about 40%, somewhere in there, depending on what state you're in and how you calculate this. However, in addition to that proposal, there was this surprise, at least the news said it was a surprise, that the capital gains tax would be retroactive to the end of April, to April of this year. In other words, it's too late to sell is the shorthand version of this. I asked Richard at the time, this seems very much like takings, Richard. Richard has a book that explores when it is that the government oversteps its a constitutional authority and takes property or assets from a citizen. Richard, a very good day to you. It seemed like takings to me, and you send me United States versus Carlton. This is the United States Supreme Court, 1994, in which I read that the court was asked to decide just such an issue when the Congress or when the administration is depriving a citizen of his assets and depriving him retroactively. In other words, he could not have known, the citizen could not have known when a decision was made about selling or buying that there was going to be an additional burden. Good day to you, Richard.
Okay. Yeah, it's even worse than that in this particular case. What happens is the United States government is always looking for gimmicks of one kind or another. And one of the things that it decided and wanted to do is to encourage a certain degree of diversification. So it says that people who invest in, you know, employer stock ownership plans, ESOPs, will get a deduction from their estate tax if they basically pay some of it with a company money. So what happens is people then go out to the market and they buy stock on their own company in order to give it to the government. And so the program turned out to mushroom far beyond its original intention because they thought that originally that the only people who would do it were those who already had the shares. They did not think about the acquisition question. And so they get a little bit panicky. And then what they decide to do is to unravel this thing. So they pass another statute which denies the deductions for people who did this with their explicit authorization and doesn't give them any compensation for whatever losses they may have incurred incidentally during the course of executing this particular plan. Then goes to the Supreme Court, and the general presumption, you say, is retroactive legislation essentially is an anathema because what it does is first you tell somebody something is legal, then you double-cross them and tell them it's illegal. But in this particular case, the Supreme Court basically did not use a strong presumption in favor of the anti-retroactivity norm. It said, you know, given the nature of the abuse in question, the kinds of issues here, we've got a bunch of earlier precedents which essentially have also allowed retroactive nullifications of prior laws, so we're going to let this thing pass. And the earlier cases were, for example, in pensions. So what you did is you joined a pension plan as a guarantor, and the United States says, the way in which we're going to make sure that we can get you in is to tell you if you don't think this thing is going to turn out to be safe, you can leave no questions asked, and we'll just let you go. Well, it turns out there's a big mismanagement of the plan, and a large number of people knock on the door and says, we want out. And what happens is the United States government turns around and says, we'll let you out, but on one condition. You pay us today the amount of money you would have had to lose if you had stayed in the plan. So essentially what they did is they double-crossed everybody on the promise that they had made. And the Supreme Court in two cases in the 1980s, one dealing with the procedural issues and one dealing with the substantive issues, came to the same basic conclusion, is you know that your government is completely unreliable. So you have noticed in the nature of things that they're likely to double-cross you. And since they're likely to double-cross you and you knew about that, you went into this with your eyes open. And so therefore what happens is the scheme is going to be essentially
Let me see if I understand. The explanation is you know the government is not to be trusted, so therefore it's your fault?
Yes. What they said is you're on notice of the fact that the government is apt to change its mind in socially destructive ways. And since you're on notice, you do this. If this argument is true, then the world comes to an end. You know, when you walk on the public street, they're on notice that there are all sorts of brigands and thieves that are out to rob you and kill you. So when you go on the public street, given that knowledge, what happens is you've assumed the risk, and therefore you have no relief when you are killed or robbed. That's the kind of argument they made. It's obviously a very bad argument. You give notice to somebody, it may be they should mitigate their particular losses by changing their conduct, but in effect what happens is even if they mitigate losses, they should be able to recover for the lesser amount of losses that they have, and that you should surely be able to enjoin somebody. The whole purpose of limited government is we know that these people can be scoundrels, and when you know people are scoundrels, then what you have to do is to create a set of legal institutions, which means that scoundrel-like behavior does not profit. That's why you put constitutions in case. That's why you have rules against government giveaways. That's why you have rules against government confiscation and so forth. And all of these cases dealing with the retroactivity principle are essentially takings. I can give you a series of very exotic retroactive cases which are not taking. Certain changes in the general law are not going to be changes if done retroactively because you do not know at the time that you make them who's going to win and who's going to lose from their application, there is no change in net wealth of any given individual. But all of these things are targeted to given individuals, and the entire purpose of the retroactive rule is a massive wealth transfer from one individual to another. There is a kind of an interesting irony about all of this. Some people say, well, what's the definition of politics? Politics is having government take money from A and give it to B. What's the definition of a taking? The same thing, taking money from A and giving it to B. And so you then have to decide, do you like the political version of this story or do you like the constitutional version of this story? I'm pretty much in favor of the constitutional version of the story, but the political version of the story carried the day in the Supreme Court. And these decisions were made by conservative justices like Justice Sandra Day O'Connor in the middle of the Reagan administration in the 1980s. So what you're looking at here is a pretty powerful trend. And the question is, what can you do to reverse it? We don't know whether this current statute will be constitutional or not. But what they're telling you, in effect, is we're freezing you. You make these trades now, and we pass this bill. You're going to have to pay a double tax. And, oh, by the way, if we don't get to pass the bill, we've still neutralized you in the interim. And so there's an interim effect. I regard the thing as per se unconstitutional. This is not an effort by the government to correct a misguided gift, the kind of situation that you had in Carlton. This is an effort by the government to wreck the capital gains market in order to fund a project that probably should not be funded at all, given their peculiar definition of infrastructure on the one hand, so broad that it really is useless, and given the fact that even if you're dealing with traditional infrastructure, these guys, given that kind of money, are likely to butcher the way which it turns out.
I want to go to a precedent that occurs to me, historical precedent, which is August of 1993, when President Bill Clinton signed a tax increase law that included retroactivity to the first of the year, is my memory.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court said, okay, is that not going to be cited in this instance?
It certainly is. I mean, as I said, when I regard something as unconstitutional, that there's no guarantee that it will happen. The Supreme Court has a different composition today than it had then. It's somewhat more conservative, though. Many of the people who are so-called conservatives are not conservative on takings type issues. They tend to be more conservative on administrative law type issues, hearing and notice and things of that particular sort. So I think there's a very good chance that this thing, if it passes, will be upheld. I think, on the other hand, it's really dangerous. And by the way, just the general capital gains increase is a catastrophe in the making, because as you increase the tax to those rates, people will cease to sell stocks that attract that kind of gain. Most of the activity will take place behind pension funds where transactions are tax-free. But these markets are going to become less efficient, and it turns out that the reallocation of capital from bad to good ventures is not going to take place. People will spend more time borrowing against their assets, creating high leverage, not changing their investment choices. And when they do that, it's just going to create a kind of a systematic inefficiency throughout the market. So this is double trouble. The rates have never been equal for ordinary income and capital gain. Now you're doing it and you're throwing this spike into it. This is going to be something that could wreck the economy. But that's par for the course with this administration.
And the retroactivity, we can expect that it will be challenged in court? the way 1993 was challenged in court, or is that a false hope?
Oh, it will surely be challenged. The issue is too big not to be challenged. You're talking about billions of dollars in potential revenues and so forth.
Right.
It will also be challenged in context. I mean, one of the things that might be done here is the Democrats are putting that in there as a strategic bargaining chip. And they'll say, we'll pull that out of the bill if you agree going forward to the higher capital gains rate. So this is not passed, and it may never pass. But what it is in effect, is a part of maneuver, given the fact that it's a credible threat that this thing will be held constitutional. Then when you get somebody to give that away in order to get the higher rates, you have the appearance of a compromise. But this is an administration hell-bent on these taxation stuff. We will know in several days what the inflation reports are, seeing whether or not this huge infusion of cash is going to change the environment. So far, the evidence is very murky. April was a bad month, but the stock market remains high. So we are in a period of maximum uncertainty.
Richard Epstein, Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, a senior fellow, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. We're speaking of the possibility of retroactive takings or charges by the U.S. government for capital gains that you might have enjoyed prior to the law, it becoming a law in Congress, whenever that is. Sometime this summer is the intention of the Biden administration. When we come back, we're going to turn to a court case that Richard's involved in in Chicago, having to do with land and trees and President Obama's legacy. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.